Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Lawrence Shainberg, author of the new book, Four Men Shaking, Searching for Sanity with Samuel Beckett, Norman Mailer, and my favorite Zen teacher from Shambhala Publications. Lawrence is author of the memoir, Ambivalent Zen, One Man's Adventures on the Dharma Path, the nonfiction book, Brain Surgeon, An Intimate View of His World, and three novels, One-on-One, Crust, and Memories of Amnesia. His fiction and journalism have appeared in Esquire, Harper's, Tricycle, and the New York Times Magazine, and he's won a Pushcart Prize for his monograph on Samuel Beckett, which was published in the Paris Review. Jonathan Lethem calls Four Men Shaking a deeply necessary utterance, one effortlessly delivered after decades of rigorous preparation. By the time I finished it, I was a fifth man shaking and with gratitude. Lawrence Shainberg, welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Now, let's first introduce the four men shaking in the book. And three of those are mentioned in the subtitle, Samuel Beckett and Norman Mailer, who became your friends, and your favorite Zen teacher, Kudo Nakagawa, who you simply refer to as Roshi in the book, and yourself, of course, as number four. In the book, you call this a four-person quadrangle. Can you tell us, Larry, the initial idea for the book and why you chose this particular quadrangle?
Well, it's each person in here is represents a certain kind of mind to me, but it's mainly it's a memoir in through states of my own mind, as they are represented by Norman Mailer, by Samuel Beckett. Each one of them represents a kind of a different approach to literature, and then of course Roshi's Zen practice is the ultimate, I think, radical position, which evolves out of those two structures.
And of course, we'll get into them individually a little later in the interview. I want to start, though, with among other things, Four Men Shaking tells the stories about your struggles to write this very book. At the beginning, you say it's been 5 years since Mailer died. He died in 2007, so this takes place in 2012, the first section. You add that you've been working on the book at that point for 6 years, and you write, "How can I be surprised that a memoir about this triangle, meaning Beckett, Mailer, and Zen, seems to be paralyzed?" What were the difficulties, Larry, that you were having in writing the book, going on 6 years at this point?
Each point in that triangle, or the quadrangle, if you like, but of Mailer, Beckett, and Zen presented its own challenges. But I was first of all just extremely intimidated by taking on these two incredible giants in literature, and Beckett being much greater than Mailer in my view, but each of them posing particular problems, and I'm not a scholar of either one. I only had my own personal experience to deal, to draw on. Beckett, is a very enigmatic figure, to say the least.
Yes.
And Mailer is a very elusive figure. So each of them had inspired a great deal of scholarship, of course, justifiably. And I did my best to familiarize myself with it, but I don't consider myself a scholar with regard to either of them. And of course, with Zen, no one dares call himself a scholar if you intend to practice it. You certainly don't want to be called a scholar. So they were relentlessly difficult subjects, and their relationship was even more difficult.
We'll get into the geometry of this four-person quadrangle. There are sections, individual sections in the book on all three men, Beckett, Mailer, and Roshi, and your relationship to them as the fourth man here. But the book begins and ends with Roshi. Was that to emphasize the Zen Buddhist aspect and then talk about Beckett and Mailer in that context?
Yes, definitely. Zen is my subject. It's the most important subject to me, and it's the circle that includes the whole quadrangle, in my view. Roshi's point of view is the most important to me and the most enduring. So you as you saw the in the first, it begins with his position on memory, which was a pretty difficult thing to come. He accused a woman who was in the car with us, one of his students, who was telling me her pretty much her life story of losing her energy to memory, which was not a very happy thing to hear for a writer who is just in the midst of a memoir. But that's the enigma, the koan, if you like, that he was always dealing with, that Zen practice deals with. And it deals, as you know, the book ends with a similar koan, but from a more personal point of view.
Yeah, in fact, you write early in the book, after that situation between Roshi and one of the other students, Kazuko, where he kind of chastises her for her lack of energy because of memory. You write, "How, if not with memory, can I expect to produce a memoir?" And of course, that's the koan, or the contradiction you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's the koan that the book is dealing with.
Now, you say in the book that you discovered Zazen in the fall of 1973. Can you tell us what led to that discovery and what attracted you to it?
Well, ambivalent Zen is more explicitly involved with that. I was very fortunate with being introduced to Zazen. I'm sorry, not to Zazen, but to Zen itself, when I was a teenager, by my father, who was the most unlikely figure. He knew nothing about the practice of Zen, as people did not at that time. We knew Zen in terms of Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, but D.T. Suzuki, for example, who was a great Zen scholar who brought Zen to this country, felt that Westerners weren't ready for Zazen, even though he himself had a lifelong practice. I mean, his whole adult life, he'd been practicing Zen, Zazen. He did not feel Westerners were ready for it. So when I discovered Zen through my father, it was more of a theoretical, ideological Zen, and fascinating stories, fascinating folk tales, some of the koans, but no one ever thought anything about sitting on a cushion. I didn't discover that till by accident when I was in my early 30s. Once I did, I just never looked back.
I'm just wondering about the difference between Zen and Zazen. Is it possible to kind of give a brief definition of each and how they differ?
Yeah, well, it's hard. I would not. They don't. They include each other. Zen itself is just series is a philosophy, if you like. It has its own literature. It is historically presented. Evolves through a series of ideas, but the practice of Zazen is moment by moment sitting on a cushion following your breath. That's all it is. It's a very concrete practice, and the concreteness of the practice is essential to the idea, as the idea is essential to the concreteness. But the practice itself is a physical one.
Now, on your first visit to a Zendo in New York, you visited as a non-member, and you really lucked out. The speaker that night was Peter Matheson.
Quite amazing.
You describe it in the book as a kind of magical karma, and I can certainly understand that. What impressed you about Matheson, and what was the connection you felt to your own life and work, Matheson's connection to your own life and work?
Well, as I wrote, Matheson was already a bit of a hero of mine, just from being a great. I aspired to do journalism and fiction, and Peter had done both. He was had excelled in both. He was also an important political activist with his work. So I knew a lot about him, but never had met him until that, and did not meet him that night. In fact, I met him later. In fact, became good friends with him. But he just was part of that group, that what we call a sangha, and they on beginners' night, or they had one of their senior students speak to the newcomers like myself, And that night, Peter had was speaking about his trip that he had just returned from that led to the book called The Snow Leopard, which is one of the great books of Zen practice that the West has produced. So it was pretty remarkable karma that brought me there that night.
Oh, yeah, and what a fascinating story. I should mention that there's an interview you did with Peter Matheson, I think it was in 1993, and that's up on the Tricycle Magazine website for anybody who wants to look that up. But he mentioned also that night, in addition to telling the story that became the Snow Leopard, that he got some advice from his Zen teacher just before he undertook the trip to Nepal and Tibet. The advice was, expect nothing. Which Matheson said got him through the worst parts of the trip. Did you also seek comfort in that advice?
I sure have. I've gotten me through some awfully difficult moments in my own trip because it is in a way, you could say that is the essential Zen teaching. You're just in the present moment, not projecting into the future, not clinging to the past. You are just here and expecting nothing from yourself. So there is that kind of freedom in our practice. And that was my introduction to it through Peter.
Now, I want to go into each of the three men, of the three of the four men shaking. You're one of them. First, I'd like to start with Roshi. When did you first meet him? I think it was the early 80s. And how did he become your teacher?
I met him, I guess, in 1979. I had heard about him. He was practicing, leading a Zendo in Israel at the time. His teacher had asked him to go there from the monastery where he was training in Japan. His teacher had met an Israeli woman, a scientist in New York, and on his travels in New York, and I mean in the United States, he had met this woman who had asked him to open a Zendo in Israel. So he asked Roshi to go there because Roshi was the only one of his monks who spoke English, though very few people would have called it speaking English. He made an attempt at it anyway. But anyway, and he headed off he did what his teacher told him to do, and he headed off in that direction without ever having heard of the country called Israel as he left for it. And he set up a small Zendo on the west bank of Jerusalem, and his reputation spread in the Zen world. It's a fairly small world, and I had heard about him as a student myself, this eccentric, brilliant teacher who was leading this Zendo in Jerusalem. So eventually I made my way over there, met him briefly there, and then he showed up in New York, and I became his student and remained so for 27 years.
Was that an instant connection? I guess there's the old saying, when the teacher arrives, you will know, the right teacher.
It's a perfect description of it, because I certainly did know. I was no doubt in my mind from the moment I met him.
Now, Norman Mailer, let's get to him. You met Mailer after sending him a copy of your previous memoir, which you mentioned, Ambivalent Zen. Apparently, he had already read it and enjoyed it, and you were both living on Cape Cod. He invited you to a dinner party, but he followed that up with just you and him at a local restaurant, Michael Shea's Barbecue in Provincetown. Can you tell us a little bit about that first one-on-one dinner with Mailer? I got to say, which involved some thumb wrestling, oddly enough.
Yes. Well, first of all, I should say that, I didn't – Mailer – I gave Mailer the book in hopes of getting a blurb from him. I knew him very slightly, superficially around Provincetown. Only met him socially a couple of times. I didn't think he would remember who I was, and I didn't have any hope of that he would actually read the book. But he called a week later, invited my wife and I to dinner, and we sat at a table with 10 other people. My book wasn't mentioned during dinner, but at the end, he pushed back from the table and pointed at me, and he said, "This guy's written a pretty good book, It's called Ambivalent Zen. You know why I like it? Because it shows me why I've always hated Zen so much. So this was actually the beginning of our friendship because Mailer, he loved nothing so much as argument. He used to say that at that time he was in his, I think he was 76 years old, but at that time he would say that argument was about the best exercise he could get at his age.
And when you met up at the restaurant, he was at that time fairly frail. He was walking around.
Not yet.
That wasn't yet.
A little later, but at that point, well, he was walking on two canes. His body his body was pretty much of a wreck. He had arthritis in both knees. He had a little breathing problems, but he was still very spirited and in relatively good shape compared to what happened in the next few years, you know, as he went down. But anyway, you asked about that first meeting. We sat
yes,
down.
Yes, and the thumb wrestling.
He just challenged me to thumb wrestling immediately. And it was my introduction to who he really was. I mean, he was a game player. He liked contest of any sort. It's why he said, he liked argument. And it was the basis of our friendship, which were endless arguments about Zen. They would continue the whole time we knew each other until his death. I don't think I ever really made a point clear to him because he was also incredibly witty and fast and smart and charming. And he was very quick to take over conversation. So I'm not particularly proud of my presentation of Zen to him, but I don't know that I could have ever overcome the wall that he presented, you know.
Now, as non-Zen as thumb wrestling sounds, to me at least, you made a connection in the book to Zen meditation where the thumbs are joined, touching lightly as if holding a single sheet of paper.
Yes.
I loved the way you connected the two.
Yeah, well, it's kind of an amazing metaphor, isn't it?
Yes.
Because in Zen practice, of course, the thumbs can help held in one's life, or touching the hands cupped in one's lap, and they become a focus of the mind. They are a very useful focus of the mind, but they are barely touching. They are both, in other words, I mean, they are both separate and together. And this is a principal koan of Zen, that of being separate and together, like we are with our own minds. We are both separate when we're observing them, and we're not separate from them at all. And this paradox is why that so-called mudra is so useful to us. But with Norman, of course, we were battling thumbs. We're trying to pin each other's thumbs.
Yes, he wasn't meditating. He was taking it very seriously.
Oh, no, he took it very seriously. He was passionate about thumb wrestling, as he had been passionate about earlier, about arm wrestling, about boxing, about gambling, betting on football games, and any kind of contest was interesting to him. He was a game player. He believed in opposition, and that was where our argument devolved in, because he believed in opposition. Say you could say between those two thumbs, those two thumbs battling each other. Whereas I believe in the practice that the thumbs are just touching and not battling, not separate, not together.
And yet both can be true. That's the contradiction.
Both can be true.
Now you found in Mailer, as you found with Peter Matheson, inspiration, because as you did, and Mailer and Matheson did, starting as fiction writers and then getting into journalism and nonfiction. You even said that Mailer was able to revive his career. You know, he started out on fire, but after that, a few poorly received novels. His first book of journalism was Armies in the Night, and you write in the book, it seemed to me that Mailer had found his voice by letting go of himself. How is journalism a way for him to let go of himself, especially, you know, given his type of gonzo, very personal, Mailer-centric journalism? And I want to add, too, how would you say that you found your voice when switching from fiction to journalism and nonfiction?
Well, Mailer was just a great act to follow. He was an amazing teacher. As a journalist, he had actually people. I've always felt that I had felt that I was a better journalist than I was a fiction writer, and could never understand at times why I persisted in the latter when I was so much better at the former. And so many people had said the same of Norman, and he was. He moved back and forth between fiction and nonfiction, as you know, starting with The Naked and the Dead and Barbary Shore and The Deer Park, three novels, and the second two being much less successful. Eventually, he found his way to Armies of the Night, which was the March on the Pentagon. And in that book, he objectified himself. He created a character named Norman Mailer.
Writing in the third person about himself.
He wrote in the third person about himself, and it was a brilliant comic device. It became a great comic. He became a great comic figure in the book. He was able to be critical of himself, to make fun of himself, and also to take very seriously a lot of things that he had been working on. And as I wrote, that book happened to come to me at a time when I needed very much to go into journalism myself, to write the book on neurosurgery when I had been involved with brain damage and trying to write a novel on brain damage, part of my Beckett mania. But Norman's book just liberated me and pushed me toward writing journalism, going toward neurosurgery.
Now that makes a good transition because I want to talk about Beckett next. And you met him, as with Mailer, through sending him one of your books. And this was the nonfiction book, Brain Surgeon, An
Yes.
Intimate View of His World, which is about a neurosurgeon you shadowed at NYU Med School, Joe Rantzehoff. What attracted Beckett to the book when you sent it to him?
Well, he was as obsessed with the brain. I didn't realize this at the time. I thought that there would be very little hope of that he would ever respond to my book. I didn't know him when I sent him the book. I sent it care of his publisher. I had sent him everything I had ever written because he had been my deity as a writer since I discovered him in my mid-20s. But anyway, he was quite obsessed with the brain, and he was quite moved by the immediate condition that I presented of people who were the calamities you describe. He wrote they left him speechless, and he was very moved. And then he wrote me a very flattering letter, which of course blew my mind completely.
Yes.
Then I was able to meet him, and we formed a bit of a friendship. He was very kind and generous toward younger writers, and I was just remarkably lucky to come into his sphere at that time.
Yeah, your first meeting was in London in 1979. He was about 74 at the time. You were there on a book tour, and he was there to actually direct one of his plays in
Yes.
London. And at that meeting, I want to get into the kind of the brain damage part and some of the things that attracted him to your book. That book about the brain surgeon. And this is from the book Four Men Shaking. It's a paradox, he continued. This is Beckett talking. But with old age, the more the possibilities diminish, the better chance you have. With diminished concentration, loss of memory, obscured intelligence, what you, I suspect, would call brain damage, the more chance there is for saying something closest to what one really is. Which
Yes.
I love that quote. That was something that must have really stuck with you to remember it that clearly.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Well, he had a way of saying things that were Beckettian.
Who
He
better to
never
say them?
failed. He almost never tried to speak, much less to write anything. I mean, even short notes in his quite extensive correspondence, almost all of his notes he took very seriously, as if it was the only chance, the last chance he would ever have to express himself on in that subject. And that night, that first night when I met him, I had just kind of offhandedly asked him how his work was going, and he got very serious before this statement that you just read. He said, I always thought old age would be a writer's best chance. But he said, I used to read the late work of Goethe and W.B. Yeats, and I had the impertinence to identify with it. He said, now, he said, my memory's gone. All the old fluency's gone. I don't write a single sentence without saying to myself, it's a lie. So I know I was right. It's the best chance I've ever had. Now, so if you know Beckett, if you know the evolution of his work and how it was all, he was always pushing to go beyond knowledge, beyond his own memory. That's why he's so important to my, to me and to many other Zen students.
Beyond language at times.
Yeah, where, beyond where language and beyond the knowing, beyond what he knows. He said that he learned that he could only write with any possibility about what he didn't know, what he didn't understand. And that was his turning point as a writer. That was when he began all of his great work.
I want to connect his quote on kind of equating old age with brain damage to your work, because at that time you had studied and written about brain damage extensively, especially in the book Brain Surgeon and then a novel, Memories of Amnesia, where you actually based on a patient that you had studied who had brain damage. And there are two lines in the book I wonder if you can talk about. One is, what is writing anyway but another form of brain damage? The second line is it possible that real brain damage is the dream of freedom from the brain?
Well, thanks for quoting it. I don't know if I understand those lines any better now than I
was hoping.
But I think that when you are as a Zen student, you understand that these paradoxes are the inherent in being a human being. And in the having, when you sit on a cushion and you're just following your breath in the present moment, you are inevitably dealing with your brain and dealing with freedom from the brain or tyranny by the brain. So these statements that you just read are inevitable development from that paradox. Particularly sharpen that paradox for somebody who's both a Zen student and a writer dealing with language and living by language as I do. There comes a time when you start to think that the brain is tyrannizing you and and it is itself a kind of damage. To have a brain is to be brain damaged. I don't like to use the term brain damage anymore because worked in the hospital as much as I did, you know, I think I know what a catastrophe it is as a clinical condition. And when I speak of it, I'm not speaking of it as a clinical condition.
More of a metaphor.
I don't like to use that term anymore.
Now, you describe Beckett and Mailer, you say it directly in the book, they're polar opposites. Beckett seems more in tune with Zen to me. You quote a line in the book from an essay he wrote on Proust. It was 1930. The quote is, the wisdom of all the sages from Brahma to Leopardi consists not in the satisfaction, but the ablation of desire, which I find a very Buddhist remark to make. And Mailer, however, seems to me somebody who is more seeking satisfaction and desire, not the ablation of desire.
That's right. That's right. And they were wonderful polar opposites. And I think both great writers, although as I've said, I think no one was in Beckett's category. Mailer was a person who he lived on developing his own his own strength and opposition and defeating his enemy. Beckett was, as he said, a person, he had early on in his career, he said that his work was about exploiting impotence, his own impotence, and going into what he didn't know, going into his lack of power, his weakness. Whereas you would never, no one who knew Mailer would ever say that about him or he about himself.
Right. Now, I imagine there was quite a bit of mutual respect between Beckett and Mailer, even though they were polar opposites. You had this wonderful line from Beckett on how he viewed Mailer's work, which sounds very Beckettian. He said, "He's a bit copious for me." It just seems perfect. What did Mailer think of Beckett's work? That it was a little too skimpy for him, or
Mailer. They are wonderful polar opposites, aren't they?
Yes.
But Mailer is famous for when Waiting for Godot opened on Broadway its famous premiere production on Broadway with Burt Lahr. Mailer was writing a column for the Village Voice, of which he was one of the founders, and he wrote an article condemning the play without having seen it. And he eventually apologized for the article, and he eventually tried to write about Beckett and understand him. And he asked me a number of times to talk about Beckett with him, but I thought he remained pretty much ignorant about Beckett. He never could get to him. He never could get to the heart of him. Whereas Beckett, as I noted, said that Mailer was just a bit copious.
Yes, which got to the heart of Mailer, I think.
yeah. And I did have occasion to tell Mailer at one time. I reported that quote to him when I was with him and his wife Norris, and I said, "Did I ever tell you about the conversation I had with Beckett once when he said that?" Yet you're a bit copious for his taste. And there was a silence. And then his wife said, "You are a bit copious."
How did he react to that? What he said, "You're right, dear," or what?
he was silent, but he could take it.
He could give it and take it. Now, the story in the book, we mentioned, of course, the three men, Beckett, Mailer, and Roshi, and your relationships with them. But it's also somewhat the story of how difficult it was to write this book. We mentioned that a little earlier, that it had been over 6 years. And you write in the book of the contradictions between your Zen practice and writing itself. There's a quote, "It seems to me that no work in the world is further from Zen than writing." And at another point in the book, you write that progressing on the Zen path requires a, quote, "freedom from self-consciousness," which seems like it could be difficult for a writer. How do you personally resolve these contradictions between writing and your Zen practice?
As I wrote earlier, the only resolution is to accept them. And my practice, Zen practice in general, I believe, is just about accepting the human contradiction as it is. I've tried my best to do that. I'd never get to the end of it. I don't know that I'm any better at it now than when I started this practice, which has now been almost 40 years ago. But writing is a way of forcing you into the center of that contradiction. So for that, it becomes a kind of Zen practice in itself, even though it is a contradiction at the heart of what Zen is, because Zen is nothing if not a challenge to the dualistic mind, and writing thrives on the dualist, depends on the dualistic mind, doesn't it?
Oh, I think the best books definitely do. Yeah, there's not just theory or some dogma that you get out of the best books. They're all contradictory.
Yes, but they're all, a language is a subject object phenomenon. It's a subject-object practice. Even for the greatest poets, they are dealing with this essential contradiction or this simple paradox. So, and thriving on it, even though Zen practice takes it to the heart, I think takes it more concretely. And the writing is also dealing with it.
Now, in the title of the book, The Four Men Shaking, we've talked a bit about Beckett, Mailer, Roshi, and you, the four men who are shaking. we haven't explained the shaking part. And when I was preparing for this, I wanted to know, it's only mentioned toward the very end of the book. So I'm not sure how much you'd like to talk about it without giving too much away, especially since I think the book ends with an extremely powerful line that I'd prefer readers to discover for themselves. So
Thank you. I would too.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to explain about the shaking part that you feel wouldn't be giving too much away, since it is such a big part of the book in terms of the title?
Yes. Very hard. It's very hard to talk about it beyond what that experience is. But everything I've been saying now is in some way implying the shaking that is a human condition, the contradictions, the ambiguities that we face, that whether we are dealing as with our own potency, as Mailer was, or with our own impotence, as Beckett was, we are always dealing with a certain kind of equivocation, equivocal condition. And this equivocation became concrete for me in the last section of the book. And as you know, it was the encouragement I got from my teacher was, again, to accept this shaking as it is. That is what we're always dealing with in Zen practice. That was the very first teaching I knew and the very last teaching that I'm writing about here.
And Roshi, of course, gets the last word in the book. But beyond that, we won't say anything more. Now, I hope this isn't an unfair question. This is my last one, Larry. Early in the book, you write, "My last memoir, which was Ambivalent Zen, brought me more questions than answers." Did you find that was also true of Four Men Shaking?
No, I don't think so. I think that I did have more the answer I wanted from Roshi. That's one that I wrote about, the last statement in the book. It is the answer. It's the only answer there is. It's not an escape, though. It's an answer that takes you deeper into the problem.
Again, I didn't want to give too much about the ending away, but I think it just ends in a way that I think not just you as a character in the book, as a Roshi's student, but I think the reader will also be very much affected by the way the book ends and Roshi's last line.
Thank you for saying it. Thank you for not mentioning it. not stating it anyway. I appreciate that.
And I appreciate very much talking with you today for Between the Covers. Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Lauren Schainberg, author of the new book, Four Men Shaking, Searching for Sanity, with Samuel Beckett, Norman Mailer, and my favorite Zen teacher from Shambhala Publications. Larry will be reading at Powell City of Books on Thursday, September 26th at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more about his upcoming appearances and his work at lawrenceschainberg.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Larry for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.